Coming up, a historian joins the show for a look at the many ways that the internet and social media are changing our understanding of the past. First, the 4th annual Black Arts Matter Festival kicks off today in Madison. The fest brings together music, visual art, and spoken word poetry to celebrate Black creativity. Events run through this Sunday, November 12th. Shasperay Irvin is co-founder and artistic director of the Black Arts Matter Festival. She's also a performance artist and ranked fourth at the 2022 Women of the World Poetry Slam. I talked to her earlier today. Now, this is, I understand, the fourth year for the Black Arts Matter Festival. You founded it back in 2019. Can you talk about the need that you saw and the vision for what the festival could be?
Yes, of course. So in 2019, I was in my undergraduate program, the theater department at UW-Madison. I noticed that there was a love for the arts and humanities in Madison across the board, but for the art forms that I participated in, Poetry Slam, for example, or Black Arts, I noticed that there was just kind of a lack of that in town, in Madison, on campus. So I wanted to provide a space, because I was always traveling out of town for festivals, to get that art.
And you started in 2019, then we had COVID, but you still got it going in 2023. How did you keep the festival rolling through some difficult times?
Yeah, due to the partnership with the Wisconsin Union Theater, they are producing the festival and have been. We actually had a completely virtual festival in 2020, so that was a really interesting year where we got to play with hosting a virtual festival and returned in 2022 and now 2023. So due to their partnership and the fundraising and grants they've been able to secure, we've been able to keep things growing and going.
You mentioned poetry slams, a lot of spoken word poetry. For people who have never been to one of these, what could they expect?
Yeah, so November 10th, we are having a poetry slam. That is something that has been a part of every festival. A poetry slam is a poetry competition where poets compete with their original works. They do original poetry from the stage, spoken word, and they're judged by randomly selected or pre-selected judges, and they compete for prizes. This year, they're competing for $3,000, $2,000, $1,000. And these are poets from all over, the top-ranked poets from all over the country coming into Madison.
What other things can people visit over the course of the festival?
Yeah, so tonight we actually have an opening reception, a celebration of 4 years of festivals with DJ Femme Noir, who's a local DJ legend in town, of which we'll have free food, so come to that. we have the Poetry Slam. We'll also have headlining Tank and the Bangas performing, Grammy-nominated artist. Super excited for that. Then we will have, we're engaging youth actually for the first time. So at My Arts on East Mifflin Street, we're actually going to be having a youth talent competition where there's going to be elementary, middle school, and high school categories for competition, as well as a vendor and art market in My Arts on the 12th.
And if people want to find out more, if they're in Madison or want to visit, where can they go for info?
Yeah, so you can always visit the Black Arts Matter Festival.org or head to the Wisconsin Union Theater website for more information about the full events. Either is fine.
Shasperay, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Shasperay Irvin is founder and artistic director of the Black Arts Matter Festival based in Madison. It starts today and runs through Sunday. Now, thanks to the internet and social media, there are lots and lots of ways to access lessons about history. From Wikipedia to TikTok, there's plenty of content about history that tries to grab our eye. But whether it's complete and accurate, that's another question. Our next guest calls it e-history, and his latest book digs into how the internet is changing our relationship with the past. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read up or listen up on history online? Have you ever come across an article or an image about history, wondered if it was the real deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Steinhauer is a public historian and author. His latest book is called History Disrupted: How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. He was a keynote speaker at the Local History and Historical Preservation Conference in La Crosse last month. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As you explain in your book, e-history covers a lot of ground, a lot of internet content. Can you give us a sense of the scope and the kinds of things we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a huge universe of content. On a platform like TikTok, for example, at this time last year, there were 58 billion posts with the hashtag history, 58 billion posts with the hashtag history. That was a year ago, so now it's well over 100 billion. On Instagram, it's somewhere in the range of 40 to 50 million. Again, that was last year, so now it's probably well over 100 million. And that's just with the hashtag history. It doesn't even include other content that alludes to history or tries to teach you something about the past or claims to be teaching you something about the past. So it's a huge universe of content. We are constantly seeing images about the past and information about history in our newsfeed every single day at any given time.
One concern you have is that a lot of times you talk to people who describe themselves as fans of some of the different kinds of content, who when they sit back and think and talk about it, think, yeah, I enjoy it, but I don't really feel like I'm learning that much from it. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You know, as part of this project and part of the work I do, I interviewed a lot of people of all different ages and backgrounds. And, you know, they'll confess that they might spend an hour or two on their phone scrolling through social media, seeing lots of e-history content as well as other types of content. And then they look up and realize that they don't remember a single thing that they looked at. Right? It's like we have all this information around us, but how much of it is actually getting through? How much of it is actually stuff that we are remembering, that we are actively learning, which is why I say that even though we're encountering a lot of e-history content online, that doesn't actually mean that we're learning anything about history. And a lot of this just goes back to how social media platforms are designed, right? They're designed a lot like slot machines. If you go to a casino and you see people in front of a slot machine, what they're getting addicted to is actually just the process of pulling the lever and having a different result show up each time. And you'll find that people can sit in front of a slot machine for hours at a time and not really even know what they're doing, just continually pulling the lever. And social media has that same effect. You end up getting stuck on your phone scrolling passively without even really realizing what you're doing. And then when you look up, you don't even know what you encountered. So you're getting addicted to the process of scrolling. You're not really absorbing any of the information.
Another concern you raise is about the source of the material. Now, someone who's an expert who's spent their whole life studying, say, I don't know, ancient Roman history could post something on TikTok. I could post something on TikTok about the same topic. I promise you they know a lot more than I do. That doesn't mean their post is going to get any more attention than mine does. Can you talk about this idea of democratizing the internet when it comes to sharing information about history?
Yeah. So what I learned researching the book was the visibility of a piece of e-history in our news feeds has no correlation to the accuracy of that information. In other words, you could put up a piece of e-history about Napoleon or Julius Caesar or the Holocaust, and it could be incredibly accurate, scholarly, rigorously researched, etc., and it might achieve no visibility online. And then to your point, someone who knows nothing about those topics could put up a piece of e-history about any one of those things and achieve great visibility and influence online. It turns out that accuracy has no bearing on how far and wide a piece of information will travel. What seems to be the real determinant is how well the content aligns with the values that are embedded in the social media platforms themselves. In other words, there are certain assumptions that have gone into the creation of these platforms, certain assumptions that have gone into the design of the algorithms. And the more that a piece of e-history content leverages those assumptions, leverages those algorithms, and leans into the values of social media itself, the more visibility the content seems to achieve. And that has profound implications for the types of information that we see in our phones and in our news feeds each day, because we're not necessarily seeing the most accurate. We're seeing the information that best aligns with the values of the social web itself.
There's another step that seems in some ways to be the most dangerous thing you call attention to, that people with certain political perspectives can create content online again, with a view not so much for accurate history as for history that aligns with their values and hopefully sways other people toward those values, or even more extreme, disinformation actors wanting to spread false information about the history, especially behind a current conflict. How ripe is that for abuse?
Well, listen, we are constantly being bombarded by information each day that attempts to persuade us to one thing or another. And sometimes that's advertising and marketing content, and sometimes it's political campaigns, and other times it's disinformation campaigns that are leveraging history. And, you know, when we think about our own context in the United States, certainly over the past few years, we have seen evidence of this. We've also seen evidence of it in Europe, in the Middle East, in China, and other places. History is a very powerful discipline, right? Information about the past really does shape and inform how we view the present and the future. And so there are all sorts of nefarious actors out there who are taking elements of the past and tweaking it or distorting it or presenting it in a way with an ultimate purpose of either persuading us to believe one thing or another, to doubting certain things that we think that we know, or purposely trying to cause divisions in society to get us to attack one another. And history, e-history online, turns out plays a critical role in that. And there are lots of examples both in the book as well as on my Substack newsletter where I go into how that plays out and what types of campaigns we're talking about.
Talking to historian Jason Steinhauer, author of the book History Disrupted, about how social media and the internet change the way we understand the past, not always for the better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a general interest in history? Where do you go for information about it? Do you look for books? Do you go to social media, YouTube for videos, for example, or a podcast? Do you worry about its accuracy? If so, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Jason Steinhauer, historian and author of the book History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you seek out information about history, where do you go for it? Are there things online that you think have really been rewarding, interesting, and informative? Join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Jason, wanted to ask you about what you would hope to see from historians and academia in supporting those historians when it comes to reaching out with better researched, better contextualized history.
Principally, I'd like to see more funding. To be honest, the history profession is increasingly under funding pressures. I actually saw that very starkly when I was in Wisconsin at the conference a couple weeks ago as the keynote speaker. I went to a couple of panels and heard from local historical societies across the state just how much of a struggle it is to continue to raise money, to bring in funds, to bring in visitors, to recruit donors, to support the type of work that history organizations and history professionals want to do when it comes to public engagement and reaching out on the web and on social media and putting accurate history into the public domain. All of that takes a tremendous amount of work, a tremendous amount of resources, and it's oftentimes resources and staff and training that institutions and historians don't have. And so part of what we've been trying to do through my History Communication Institute, which is the organization that I started a couple years ago, is to bring more funding into this space to help publicly engaged scholars do this type of work.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Darlington. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I will admit that I'm a huge fan of history content on the internet, especially YouTube. And I think it's really wise to caution people about, you know, quality is not always there. You know, you have to be a real critical thinker when you're consuming this content. I do just have a couple follow-up questions, though, that your expert follow-up questions about comments that your expert made. One was the comment was that there's no correlation between quality and accuracy compared to popularity. Mm-hmm. And my follow-up question is that was there a regression study on that, or is that an opinion? And my second follow-up question, then I'll take your comments off the air. My second follow-up question is, you said that what does control popularity of content is the values of the platform. And certainly it's based on algorithms, but I'm not sure that's true, because I happen to know that the popularity of YouTube content, for example, tends to mostly have to do with how many people liked that content, how many people commented on that content. And that is, I consider to be a pretty big indicator of perhaps quality, but also the entertainment value of the content, and not necessarily directly just values or whims of the platform creator. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on those follow-up questions.
John, thanks for the call. Jason, do you want to flesh that out a little?
Yeah, so I'd say that to the first question, so that's research that was done over 5.5 years. That's all detailed in the book. Don't have time today to go through all of it, but if you're interested in it, I would encourage you to pick up the book. It's called History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past, and it's peer-reviewed, highly footnoted, so you can see where all that information comes from and decide for yourself what you think about it. The second question is sort of related to the first in some way. I would say this, right? The platforms, as I mentioned, they have certain assumptions built into them. And one of the assumptions that built into them is that the more attention that people are giving something, the more visibility it should be given in the feed. So this kind of reinforces what the caller was saying, right? That's an assumption that is built into many platforms, including YouTube, that visibility is oftentimes linked with how many people in a crowd are commenting or looking at something. That has no correlation with accuracy, right? Because lots of people can be looking at something and commenting on something, and it could be wildly inaccurate. And so I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to get people to think about critically, is just because something is getting a lot of views and getting a lot of comments, and as a result, getting a lot of visibility in your feed and showing up on your phone when you go to YouTube and conducting searches, that doesn't mean that it's accurate. That doesn't mean that it's based on the most recent scholarship. That doesn't mean that it aligns with what professional historians think about a particular subject. And YouTube doesn't take what professional historians think about a particular subject into consideration when it's creating and ranking its algorithm. So that's what I mean by, like, the assumptions that go into the algorithm are what dictates visibility, and that has profound consequences for what we see and what we don't see.
John, thanks for that call. Talking to Jason Steinhauer, historian, author of the book History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past. Sarah joins us now in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. Well, you know, I have had this pet peeve in the last few weeks because I'm a like Beatle maniac from back in the 70s. I'm not quite old enough to be one in the 60s, but so I've been really into reading about them and sharing stories about them on the social media site I'm on. And I've just found that the younger fans and even some of the older ones, they just believe a lot of things that are just completely not true because it's just shared on the internet so often. You get these supposed facts that people share, and they're just not true. And there's a couple sites online that are very authentic. I mean, the really well-researched. And if you go to there, you get the right information. But not that many people will go to these sites. They just believe what they read. And I've been a little bit upset lately because I feel like in 50 years, no one's going to really know. There'll be all this, like, just made up stuff, or the mythology about the Beatles is going to be what they believe, and it's just not true.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Jason, you write in the book, it's not just the Beatles. We end up with sometimes a popular consensus on history that, as Sarah suggests, they have nothing to do with the actual history.
Yeah, and Wikipedia is a great example of this, and I appreciate Sarah's comment the caller's comment, because that's exactly what I was trying to illustrate with the last point, right? If a lot of people believe something, even if it's not accurate, even if it's not grounded in what actually happened, it can take on a life of its own very quickly online. And on Wikipedia, for example, I have examples of this in my book. If enough editors and contributors get behind some sort of myth or popular consensus that isn't actually true or isn't actually accurate or isn't grounded in what actually happened, it can sort of take on a life of its own and show up in the entry. And then once it's on Wikipedia, because so many people go to Wikipedia for information, it can then spread very quickly. So for example, YouTubers who make history videos, they're not doing original research most of the time. What they're doing is going to Wikipedia, taking the information that's there, and then repurposing it into a video. So if consensus forms on Wikipedia that something is true that isn't, it can then be picked up by YouTubers, by TikTokers, by Amazon Alexa, and spread very quickly across the web. And sooner rather than later, you have the phenomenon that was just described, that there's a whole world out there that believes X when the truth was actually Y.
Thanks for that call. Jason, in our just last half a minute, if somebody's out there thinking, gosh, I'm interested in history, I'm not a professional, well, where the heck should I start? Do you have some starting points for them?
Well, I would say first one would be my Substack newsletter, jasonsteinhauer.substack.com, because what I try to do is actually not recommend particular sites or platforms one over the other because there's so much content out there, but rather give people tools through which to think about these issues. And a lot of those tools and a lot of those case studies are on my Substack newsletter. So if you go there, you'll start to see some different ideas and insights into how we deal with this massive e-history universe that we have created. And hopefully some of those can then be useful as people navigate across the web.
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Steinhauer, public historian and author. He talked to us about his book, History Disrupted, How Social Media and the World Wide Web Have Changed the Past, looking at how we treat history on the internet. We'll get a link up to that newsletter he just mentioned over at WPR.org/Central Time.